From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the corruption trial that has been anticipated for years is now underway in a federal courtroom in Chicago. Prosecutors are laying out their case against the former Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan, and his confidant, Michael McLean. What happened during the first week and what may be ahead? We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And also we have with us Hannah Meisel, reporter with Capital News Illinois. She's been covering the trial. And Hannah, it's good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
So this trial, I mean, I don't think I'm going out on a limb, Hannah, to say it's probably the biggest public corruption case we've seen in several years, and there have been some pretty big ones. The case against them alleges that Michael Madigan and Michael McLean engaged in racketeering and bribery and abused the former speaker's power, forming what has been termed a criminal enterprise by prosecutors. So the first witnesses were called this week. We got to hear the opening statements. And what did you take away from this so far? What is this case going to look like as we go forward?
So the trial is going to be very lengthy, taking us up possibly right up till Christmas. And, you know, it's going to be basically in three main parts, two of which we've already seen aired at separate related trials earlier last year and last month. As people might remember, Mike McLean, a longtime State House lobbyist, a close friend of Mike Madigan's, he was already convicted for his part in this alleged bribery scheme, the so-called ComEd 4 trial, which I sat through last March, April, May. And in that, the four former lobbyists and executives of ComEd were accused of bribing Madigan, not with cash, but with jobs and contracts for the speaker's political allies in exchange for some pretty key pieces of legislation in Springfield for ComEd's business. We also saw last month evidence aired alleging the former president of AT&T Illinois basically did the same thing as ComEd, albeit on a much smaller scale, same thing, a contract with a political ally of Madigan's in exchange for legislation. On that one, of course, though, the jury ended up deadlocking and a mistrial was declared. Next month, we'll hear some arguments on possible acquittal in that case. But, you know, the third thing that we really haven't seen aired much because there hasn't been a separate trial is everything having to do with Madigan soliciting business for his property tax law firm, Madigan and Getz & Danner. This gets into the pretty extensive cooperation that former Chicago Alderman Danny Solis did for the government, wearing a wire, agreeing to have his phone calls listened to by the FBI, you know, providing a lot of information. And, you know, we also know that this is kind of how the FBI started looking into this case. And, you know, an FBI agent was on the witness stand yesterday and acknowledged that, you know, Madigan has always been part of this investigation going back to 2014, but he wasn't the focus of the investigation for a lot of those years. So it's going to be a lot of repeats. You know, certainly this week we've had all repeat witnesses and mostly repeats of wiretapped phone calls that we've heard in the courtroom. But, you know, definitely some new things, too, coming up. But it's going to be a very, very long trial.
Charlie, we were talking a little bit before the show, and certainly some of the things that have been alleged against Madigan, I think if you look at it by statute, certainly you could say, yeah, this may be breaking the law. This may be illegal. But that has been the way business has been done in government in a lot of the years that you've covered it and I've watched it. But at the same time, times have changed. Madigan may not have kept up with the changing times.
Yeah, I think that may be part of it, because one of the arguments that from the opening statements, what the defense is going to be making is that the things that McClain was doing with relationship to Madigan, it was part of lobbying. And part of lobbying is you try and build up these relationships with people. You try and make friends. You try and do favors. And it's a two-way street. And it's not a crime. And part of it, as we were talking before, Sean, is that back in the day, the era in which Michael Madigan came of political age, that was part of the job, was you take care of your friends. That was expected. I know it used to be that if you lived in the city of Chicago, you had any type of problem at all, if you had, you need trees trimmed, garbage picked up, streets plowed, whatever it was, you wouldn't call the city, you'd call your alderman or your precinct captain. And that was just the way things were done. And things have changed. And Madigan was pretty much old school, and I don't think he may have adjusted to the new reality as well as he might have. One of the things I found surprising was, not surprising, but interesting, was the first two, a couple of the first two people who were brought to testify were a couple of former lawmakers, Scott Drury and Carol Sente, and they talked about how much control Madigan had over bills, whether they would be sent to committee, whether they'd be brought out of committee, whether they could pass the House. And I'm thinking to myself, that's the way it's always been. The Speaker, or for that matter, the Senate President, has pretty much absolute control. That's the individual who names people to committees, to chairmanships, to his leadership team, determines which bills get out of the Rules Committee in the House or the Assignments Committee in the Senate. The only exception to that, and this really dates me, is back in the mid-70s when the Democrats won control of the Illinois Senate, and a group of what today would be called progressive lawmakers held out their votes for Senate president, demanding a greater share in the power structure. They were called the Crazy Eight back then, and it took 176 ballots to elect the Senate president. And part of the deal was that the holdouts agreed to vote for Tom Hines for Senate president. And in return, they got a couple spots in leadership. They got, they all got committee chairs, some of them pretty important committees, executive committee, appropriations committee, judiciary, things like that. And they had a share in the dealings and the workings of the Senate. And that went on during the time Phil Rock was president. And it lasted until 93 when Republicans won control. Pate Phillip became Senate president and was back to the old days where basically the leadership made all the big decisions. And so as I say, I don't know if the idea was somehow to paint Madigan as being out of the ordinary, that this is something that back in other instances before Madigan or in the Senate, we didn't have this kind of control by whoever the leader was. And I'm thinking, well, that's always been that way, as I say, with the exception of the Crazy Eight.
Well, I'm wondering, and Hannah, you know, maybe weigh in on this if you can. I'm wondering if prosecutors are trying to set it up to say Mike Madigan knew everything that was going on. He was aware of absolute everything. He called all the shots. So if we're going to say he did something illegal, it wasn't that he could blame it on somebody else. He may try to, but that he was the one who was really calling the shots here. Is that your thought on what prosecutors are trying to set up?
Well, that's certainly the picture that they are trying to paint, and they're painting it fairly on early on in the trial, which I think is, a strategy to show the jury just how widespread Madigan's power was, just how meticulous he was in all of his dealings. So, in opening statements, Madigan's defense was, he couldn't possibly know what people were saying about him behind his back on all these wiretap calls. So prosecutors turn around and they played, it was almost three dozen calls yesterday. And in a lot of them, it showed, established just how close Madigan and McClain were you know, all of these calls in which they arrange dinner, one in which Madigan used McLean's cell phone because, of course, the speaker famously doesn't have a cell phone. And he called his wife, Shirley, and read her the menu of a restaurant for soup. There's broccoli cheddar, there's egg drop, whatever. And then they also, you know, they played a series of calls in which basically Madigan sends McLean to do something, to do his bidding, basically. Of course, one episode that has been aired at two other trials that I've now written about three times is former House Majority Leader Liu Lang. In the fall of 2018, McLean was dispatched to basically get Lang to retire when he really didn't want to, when a woman was going to come forward and accuse him of sexual harassment if he was reinstated to leadership. Of course, Lang had wanted to ascend in leadership, and he even said, you know, on the stand yesterday, as he said other times when he's testified, that he wanted to someday maybe even become speaker. But McLean had to, you know, call him and give him a very cold reality check. You know, several other calls in which Madigan directed McLean to do something, like stop fundraising for a certain member, or, you know, ask a lobbyist to leave him alone. And so, you know, in all of these things, prosecutors definitely want to portray that Madigan was all-powerful, all-knowing, and that he, you know, with a very light touch could control everything, and that he directed everything in Springfield. That's the message they want to send to the jury.
Yeah, Charlie, I got to say, that Liu Lang moment that Hannah was mentioning, and I heard some of the tape of that, you know, whether you like Liu Lang or not, he was a pretty good lieutenant for Michael Madigan through the years, and was a, you know, floor leader for the Democrats in the House, and, you know, did a lot of the work that they needed. And I thought, is that the way that you're going to tell this guy he needs to go? You couldn't have him come sit in your office and have a face-to-face conversation with him? It just seemed very strange to me. Maybe that's how Madigan did business. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think what was interesting to me was Lang's reaction, at least, and Hannah, you were there. He didn't seem like he was angry and, damn Mike Madigan, he did this to me. It was like he was kind of philosophic about it. Well, I realized then that my career had come to a dead end and I had to look for other things to do.
Yeah, Hannah, is that the way, is that the way you took it from what you heard on that tape?
You know, we have to account for the fact that it's been now 6 years. He's had a lot of time to heal from that. And I'd imagine that he was pretty upset at the time. But yes, in the wiretap phone call, he was very calm when he's talking to McLean. I think ultimately, like he said on the stand, he realized that his career had come to a dead end and that basically nothing that he could do could convince Madigan otherwise. And so he was kind of stoic about it.
Charlie, I wanted to ask you, because you have this background, you've known who Michael McLean is going way back. Most people probably don't. Even a lot of people who follow state government closely probably didn't know who he was, may not have realized he had as much of a connection with Madigan, but he goes pretty far back. Their relationship goes far back, right?
Yeah, they both kind of started at the same time in the mid-70s in the Illinois House. Well, Madigan was at the beginning, right after ConCon, he got into the House. But yeah, and one of the things, if I'm recalling correctly, when it came time to do redistricting after the 1980 census and Democrats won the right to draw the boundaries, one of the things that Madigan did or wanted to do was to draw a district that would be pretty favorable to McLean's reelection. And McLean said, no, take these areas and try and create another Democratic district kind of outside of Quincy. They went ahead and did it. And McLean lost his reelection bid. And he became a lobbyist, and he was always very close to Madigan. They remained good personal friends for all these years, 50 some years. So yeah, they go back a long way. And they had a sense of loyalty to one another. And I think one of the tensions that's going to arise here, and Hannah, maybe you can comment on this. I get the impression that McLean's defense wanted to have his trial separated from the Madigan trial because there was some concern that Madigan's lawyers would try and throw McLean under the bus and say, oh, well, the speaker didn't know about any of this. This was all McLean freelancing.
Yeah, that's right. This summer, that's what McLean's attorney said in legal filings. But then the government shot back and said, well, this could be kind of a ruse to keep on protecting Madigan, even as, you know, the ship goes down, you know, in a display of extreme loyalty. Of course, we saw that extreme loyalty extend to Tim Mapes, Madigan's former chief of staff, who was convicted last summer in a 3-week trial. He was convicted on 2 counts of perjury and attempted obstruction of justice after he lied to a grand jury in March of 2021. This is, you know, a year before Madigan ultimately got indicted. But after McLean and the other ComEd folks had been indicted. So, you know, this type of extreme loyalty is not unusual in Madigan's world. You know, we've heard from other folks, you know, the people who went through Madigan's staff for years and ran campaigns for him and then went on to very successful careers in lobbying as a result, you know, of course that's going to breed loyalty. It's definitely interesting in the courtroom. For the most part, they avoid each other, although after the first week of jury selection, the two of them did have a brief moment on that, I think, Friday afternoon, and they shook hands and exchanged words, but none of us reporters, actually there was only one reporter in the courtroom at the time because we were limited by the judge, but we don't know what they said, but it's been very interesting. McLean's wife and sons are there every day, a member of Madigan's family. They might be rotating who's there every day, but they've had a bit of interaction with each other, but for the most part, they're avoiding each other. It's just got to be very, very strange to have your 50-year friendship kind of end like this.
Well, Hannah, also, I guess when I look at this case, I keep wondering, we kind of get an idea what the federal government is pushing against Madigan, what they are alleging and how they're going to build their case. Do we have a pretty good sense of Madigan's defense?
Well, I mean, I think there's going to be a couple things. Like you mentioned earlier, like Charlie was talking about, that it's not illegal to give job recommendations, that it's not, you know, illegal, it's more on the McLean side, to be a good lobbyist, to build these relationships. But also what we were talking about earlier, you know, a lot of his defense is going to be, Madigan didn't know what other people were saying behind the scenes doing with his power. And certainly we all know that to take people with a grain of salt when they're bragging that they're close to whatever source of power, certainly we all know people in the State House who are like that. And we know to take what they say, you know, with some advisement, I guess. But, you know, a lot of Madigan's defense will also just be that he was a good, effective leader. Although, you know, at every turn, prosecutors are going to try to block testimony that they say has nothing to do with the case. We already saw that in jury selection when one of Madigan's attorneys had there was someone on the stand who happened to be someone with a seminary background, who happened to be actually someone who went to seminary down in Quincy at an institution that Mike McLean's familiar with. And because of this person's, history with the Catholic Church, the questioning got into, would you, you know, have a prejudice if you were to find out that Mike Madigan supported things like abortion rights? and stuff like that during his 50 years in the legislature. Prosecutors immediately jumped on that. So we'll see how much basically they're able to get through. But, you know, prosecutors have said over and over, this is not about any particular piece of legislation. This is not about Madigan's leadership. This is solely about his alleged criminal conduct.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on Madigan's defense here? We've talked about it a lot through the years. Through the last couple of years, really, and we've also talked about it based on some other events that have occurred, including Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So, you know, do you think the federal government has it's going to be a difficult prosecution here? Usually, the federal government's pretty good at this stuff.
Yeah, and I think. And you guys can correct me if my memory is not accurate on this, but I'm pretty sure when the trial of the AT&T executive wound up with a hung jury, that was maybe the first setback that the feds have had in these kinds of cases that I can recall. And I think a couple of things, the idea that what went on in Madigan's world in terms of recommending people for internships, recommending people for jobs, that kind of thing, doing favors, that doesn't constitute a bribe under the new Supreme or the latest Supreme Court, that would seem to suggest there actually has to be a quid pro quo, almost the case of money changing hands, an envelope stuffed with $100 bills passed from one individual to another. And that did not occur in Madigan's case, and it's not being alleged. And I think another tack that the feds are going to take, or I'm sorry, that the defense will take, will be to try and undercut some of the witnesses. Former Alderman Danny Solis, will be a witness. He's been a witness in other cases. And in the opening arguments, I think it was John Mitchell, and was he a defense attorney for McLean?
That's correct.
McLean? Yeah. So John Mitchell, one of the defense attorneys for Michael McLean, described Danny Solis, and this is basically quotes. He said that he told the jury that Solis stole hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign funds, received bribes that included cash, Viagra, and prostitutes. He lied to prosecutors, a grand jury, his own wife and family, and he now vacations to tropical islands. And that was based on the fact that Solis became a mole and he's not facing any prison time or you know, any real repercussions legally. Mitchell says, you'll see what a real criminal looks like. You'll see what a real public corruption defendant looks like. It'll take him a week to testify about all the bribes he took. So the defense, as I said, is going to say, well, this is not criminal. The doing favors part is not criminal. Building relationships is not criminal. That's what lobbying is about. And on the other hand, the folks that you, the prosecutors, are going to bring in are people who are basically liars, and they did it to save their own skin.
Well, just a couple of minutes left here, and we'll be following the Madigan trial, of course, all the way till the end, maybe even beyond. But did want to mention another story that, Hannah, you had written about a few weeks ago, and we did discuss it briefly on the show at one point before, but this was a report on gambling that was released by the state. We have a new major player when it comes to the gambling industry in Illinois, that is sports betting. Tell us about this. What do the numbers start to show us about the landscape for wagering in Illinois?
This is an annual report from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. And, you know, sports betting, like you said, becoming a huge, huge part of Illinois' gambling landscape. But it's also remarkable to just look at the continued rise of these video gaming terminals, you know, the things that you see in bars, restaurants, truck stops. They are just, they're huge. And, you know, there's, even though there's been, you know, slowdowns predicted for years, it doesn't really seem like it's going to be slowing down anytime soon. Especially, you know, you have, a couple dozen municipalities in Illinois have been holdouts who have banned, you know, said we will not have video gaming here. But, you know, City of Chicago is, you know, of course, the largest of those. And if the city decides that, in fact, they would like that tax revenue, which, of course, anyone who has paid any attention to Chicago in recent years knows that the city definitely does need that tax revenue. They might, you know, decide to reverse that decision and take that. And, you know, we would see video gambling take off even more so. But continued picture of a slowdown at most of Illinois's 10 land, you know, riverboat casinos, with the exception in displaying the land casino, the Rivers Casino there. And of course, the continued, you know, basically demise of horse racing. Kind of a sad story of an industry that used to be very, very active and, you know, really important to Illinois' economy, important to Illinois agriculture, just continuing to get beaten down to its last legs.
Charlie, I'll give you about 30 seconds here. I know you read that report as well.
Yeah, and I will point out, as Hannah noted, the city of Chicago does not have these video gaming terminals. Given their budget pressure, I would not be surprised if at some point they decide to do it. But as a kind of a footnote, and I think I mentioned this before, the municipality that has the most video gaming terminals is the city of Springfield, with 837 as of the end of fiscal 2024. So there you go.
All right. Well, let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie, we'll stay with you to have your note.
Well, there was another report that came out from the Illinois Community College Board. They reported that enrollment at community colleges in the state has seen its largest fall-to-fall increase since fall of 2009. The headcount for fall, and it was reported, I believe, on the 10th day of classes, was 265,227, which was 7.4% higher than fall of 2023. That includes 82,890 students who are enrolled full-time, almost a third of the total.
And Hannah?
At the Republican National Convention, Democratic National Convention, we had, you know, official predictions from House Minority Leader Tony McCombie saying Republicans could pick up 5 seats. House Speaker Chris Welch saying that he thought the Democrats' 78 majority, which is truly just astronomical, could grow even more. This week, we had Leader McCombie slightly revise her prediction down to 4 with what she called 2 sleepers. Then we had Illinois Democratic Party Chair Lisa Hernandez say that she thought the House could grow to its Democratic majority to 82.
All right, but we'll find out soon. That's all of the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.